Jeff Griggs, a theater and improv veteran, has worked at Second City and Improv Olympic, two of the best-known improv and sketch theaters in the country. His place on staff at both DePaul University and Columbia College in Chicago makes his perspective on teaching unique, one that spans higher education and stages that dot the Windy City. So how do you teach comedy? I'm Dave Kanner, and that's up next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Kind of explain what improv means in the context that you teach it, since the term kind of signifies different things in different settings. So can you kind of give us a concise explanation of that?
That'll be a good challenge. Well, yeah, a lot of times everybody hears improv and they automatically think it means being funny or it means comedy. And improv that we have always explored is that idea of being in the moment and teaching people how to listen, how to react. And it is the study of being in the moment and being able to respond and react in that moment.
There's an entire language around the discipline. So, you know, coach, teams, games, forms. So do you know how that language was codified, I guess? And can you kind of give us a couple kind of key terms, I guess, that would make the rest of this conversation more understandable to a lay audience?
Yeah, especially those terms that you were speaking of, coach, players. That started because in the middle days of improv, it was a competition in comedy clubs. And so a lot of theaters developed improv with that idea of you're competing against each other and you have a coach who is the person in charge of you. And then you are a player in this team, and it's all about collaboration and all about succeeding together as a team. And so those are the sort of labels that were given for improv in the 80s and 90s. And I think we have pulled back a little bit to things being as a director and as partners. And you are using things like yes and, which is the most important aspect of improvisation, which is someone says something to you and you don't have to agree to what they're saying, but you have to encourage further thought on it. So you yes the statement and you add to it with that idea that we're building on top of that.
It was interesting that you kind of said it didn't have to be funny. Improv does not have to be funny, I guess. When you see performances today, I guess, do they skew kind of in that direction? I mean, I've definitely seen scenes that are not funny, but I don't know if that is purposeful.
It's probably not purposeful. Yeah, if you go to a comedy theater, it usually is thought of as something that where you're trying to make people laugh without trying to be funny. So you're saying things, but you're really saying things in the manner that people would normally say them. So it's really about honesty and truth and reacting in a way that people normally would react. And hopefully by people recognize that, that will make them laugh. And so that's the goal when you're at a comedy club or an improv theater. when you expand beyond that, there is a lot of improv that isn't necessarily funny. There's a lot of films that use improvisation and a lot of television shows that use improvisation. And I use it in classroom setting, teaching. And I'm teaching collaboration skills, listening skills, presentation skills, editing skills, and all of those things are used as a way to further people and the way that they interact with each other without having to be funny.
So you teach at Columbia College in Chicago, DePaul, and Second City. So can you talk about teaching improv in kind of all these different settings and how the ideas might be presented differently because of kind of the school of thought behind each one of those institutions?
Oh, yeah, because they are very different. When I'm teaching at IO or Improv Olympic, the idea is to teach improv in a pure form where people will get a suggestion and then they will then create a 30-minute, sometimes 45-minute, sometimes hour performance piece based off from one suggestion. When I'm working at Second City, I'm utilizing improv as a way to develop sketch material. So we're using the suggestions from the audience and using suggestions from each other to create content that we'll put onto a stage. And then when I'm at Columbia and DePaul, depending on what class I teach, if I'm at DePaul, I'm teaching improv for filmmakers, and I'm a lot of times teaching directors and writers how to utilize improv to create content, but also how to use improvisational skills to communicate with each other and to collaborate. And at Columbia, there's a comedy studies program that is designed around people furthering their careers as comedians. And so we use improv in all of those forms as a way to advance your idea if you're a stand-up or if you're a writer or if you're a filmmaker. And so improv is used throughout all of those.
Could you talk about the Columbia program, I guess, because it seems kind of unique. I believe there's a comedy writing program at NYU and there are other various kind of writing programs, but this seems more specific to improv, I guess, with your kind of inclusion on the faculty.
Yeah, it's a program with coordination at Second City, and the idea is that you have people who want to concentrate on comedy in some sort of form, whether it be as a writer or as a stand-up or as a filmmaker or any sort of form that they're looking to utilize comedy. And then they go through classes in their four-year program at Columbia College, and it culminates in them spending a whole semester at Second City every day. And so they'll have a movement class, they'll have a comedic acting class, they'll have a history and analysis of comedy class, as well as an improvisation class, and several different writing workshops in there as well to sort of concentrate on how you write a spec script or how you write a sketch for the stage. And so it hopefully takes in all of those forms for people who are wanting to be a comedians or wanting to utilize comedy. And a lot of people then take that and utilize that as a way to improve their skills in their job, even if they don't go into comedy. We have lawyers who come take the classes with that idea of making it so that they are more effective at communicating to their clients or to judges or to people who they are communicating with daily. So it's a unique program, and there aren't very many out there like it, and it's the first of its kind.
You already mentioned kind of other disciplines or vocations finding improv useful in some way. So you gave an example of a lawyer. Is there a more surprising example, I guess? Because being an attorney is very much still a kind of performance.
There are a lot of different people who come into classes, whether it be at IO or Second City at the training center there. We also travel around the country and around the world, actually, teaching improv to people to help them effectively communicate with each other and collaborate with each other. And so I didn't do this one personally, but a couple of our facilitators at Second City went to China and were on a cruise ship in China and were teaching the blackjack dealers improv as a way to get them to interact with the people who were at the tables to make people feel more comfortable as they were sitting there. And so it's a skill that we also have gone to pharmaceutical companies to help teach empathy and collaboration. A lot of tech companies bring us in. And I had a midwife come and take 6 levels of classes as a way for her to better enhance and develop her listening skills when she is in the middle of a procedure.
You mentioned levels. Can you kind of just explain levels to folks? Because not all of this is, these are not always classes in a degree program, I guess.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. If you take classes at one of the theaters around, especially in Chicago, but I know there's a lot of improv theaters all around the country, and usually they have levels, and that first level is an entry level with that idea of, we're coming in with this idea that you have no idea about anything with improv, so we're going to teach you the basics and how we approach improv. And then if you like that, then come in for another 8-week class for your second level. And when you're at Second City, there's a couple different levels that you can go through. There's the 8th through E program, which is for sometimes hobbyists or people who are very interested in sometimes just coming and hanging out with people for 3 hours and making new friends and developing relationships and getting better at being funny and getting better at their jobs. And then when you become serious about it and think, you know, maybe this is a career path, or maybe it's something I'd like to do a lot. Doesn't have to be a career. It could be just sort of a side thing I do. We have a conservatory, and the conservatory is where people come in, you audition to get in, and then you're really about developing a show, and you create a full show at the end of 6 levels. And you put on a show, you invite all your friends and your family, and if you have an agent, they come and see it. And there's we have writing classes that are also in levels of people wanting to develop sketch or develop screenplays. And there's even a film school at Second City that is a year-long process where people come and learn how to make comedic films.
So I think you saw a performance of a Second City show when you were in high school. And what made you, I guess, want to pursue what you saw on stage?
Well, when I was in high school, my teacher, Deanne Jones, was one of the most influential, important people in my life. I auditioned and got into a play and then started taking her drama classes. And part of our drama classes, she had this book up in the corner that was Viola Spolin's Games for Children. And then she would go up, grab that book, and we would do exercise off from it. And that was the most fun thing I'd ever done. And we happened to go to Illinois High School Theater Association Festival. And at that festival, Second City was performing. And I just remember sitting in the audience and just feeling a glow around myself as I just sank into the chair and absorbed everything. And I thought, this is what I should be doing. And it took a while for me to get up the guts to do it. I went to college, then got a job, and then finally got fired from a job and thought, this is the world telling me that I should move to Chicago. And I did, and started taking classes at Second City and IO.
It took you a while to start kind of doing improv. You lived in Southern Illinois and worked at a radio station. And you said you eventually got the courage up to move to Chicago and give it a shot. And I imagine you talking about Del Close is just inevitable, I guess, at this point in interviews. So you wound up working with Del as ostensibly an assistant and helped him on errands. But can you explain his kind of place in improv and how your experiences kind of, they gave you enough insight to write a book called Guru, My Days with Del Close?
Yes. Yeah, so I was taking classes at Second City. And while I was taking classes at Second City, one of my teachers pulled me to the side and said, if you're serious about this, you need to go take classes with this guy, Del Close. And so I did. And I was taking classes at that place and another comedy club in Chicago called the Annoyance Theater. And I was taking classes at all three places. And it was very expensive. And so I decided that I didn't know if I could take it anymore and told the owner of the theater. And they said, you know what? You can intern and your job will be, you're going to drive Del Close around. And he is a unique person who is a lot of times credited with being the father of long form improv. He was a Second City performer and director. He performed with Mike Nichols and Elaine May and all of the greats, and then went on to direct people like John Candy, Bill Murray, John Belushi, and was a very influential person and had a crazy, wild career, wild life, was fired from many different jobs, and was in Chicago teaching improv, and I went and took classes with him. And then once a week, I would go pick him up at his home, and I would drive him around to run his weekly errands. And it became a couple times a week, and it became phone calls all the time. And he became sort of a mentor for me, sometimes teaching me things that I knew I would never do, and sometimes teaching me, a lot of times teaching me things that I would do as an artist, just not as a person.
Is there kind of a manner of instruction that you saw him engage with that informs your work today? What kind of teacher was he?
He was someone who was known as a intimidating person because he was very direct and very straightforward. And so people were scared of him. And then taking the classes, I started to realize that this was sort of this character that had been created that wasn't exactly him. He was direct, but that's what you want. You want someone to tell you if you're doing something wrong. You want someone to tell you if you're going in the wrong direction. And that was very important for me to see and to understand that I'm not helping anybody by letting them continue to go in the wrong direction. If I can help guide them in a direction, that is more useful. And so that was very important to learn. And the other thing that he really ensconced inside of me was this idea that we're in improvising, we are searching for honesty and we're searching for truth. And you don't want to sell out any of that just for a cheap laugh. You want the honesty and truth of human nature to be displayed on the stage. And it's something that I use as a writer, as an improviser, as a filmmaker. I try to take all of that, and I use it as a teacher to give that idea that we are working together to create honesty and truth.
So this is kind of a form of generosity, I guess, as you're performing. And I assume he talked about that. But again, school to school or kind of various approaches might foreground a certain approach. But so you can be in a scene and not be funny, but still contributing to a sketch's success. So can you talk about that a little bit? And then how do you impart that to students who, I assume there's a certain personality that goes along with wanting to be on stage in front of people?
Yeah, so yeah, that's true. People navigate to it with that idea that, you know, I'm funny and I want to be funny. And I, as a director and as a teacher and as a performer, want you to be funny as well. But a lot of times You are funny when you make your scene partner look good. So your goal is to set up your scene partner, and your scene partner is going to set you up. So it's all about concentrating on your scene partner to try to make them look as good as possible. And in turn, they'll return that, and we'll both be elevating each other. And, you know, sometimes that flies in the face of our natural instincts, because as you're saying, yeah, a lot of times I want to be funny and I get a little panic. So I want to make sure that I get a laugh. But sometimes the scene works better if your partner gets the laugh. So you don't rush to get that joke. You rush to set your other person up, because that's what serves the scene and serves the character and serves the relationship.
You mentioned differentiating between short form and long form. So can you explain that? And this also, I guess, circles back to the kind of insular language around improv. But then can you also explain what the Herald is and how that's associated with, I guess, Chicago?
There is a language designed around the different forms that come in improv. There is what is called short form. And short form is you get a collection of games, you put them together, and each one exists on its own as a sort of game, something like you would see from Whose Line Is It Anyway? And that's the one that's most recognizable for everybody. Long form is a type of improv where you get one suggestion and you create an entire performance based off from that one suggestion. You don't stop it in between. You take that inspiration and if you take the suggestion of Lemon, one group of people does a scene based off from Lemon. Another person might take a suggestion off of Tartness from that Lemon, and another group might take something off a lemon meringue pie. So you all are finding different inspiration for what you're creating, and you're building to create this all-encompassing piece. And that is what long form is. Short form is usually around 30 minutes, could be an hour. Herald is usually around 40 minutes, could be an hour. And then you have the Herald, and the Herald is a combination of short form and long form, in that you're getting a suggestion, you're in front of the audience, taking that suggestion and creating an inspiration, sort of a theme in front of them in an opening. Then you will do
these suggestions are coming. You're prompting the audience to give you a suggestion. You're for instance with Lemon. So someone comes out on the stage and says, "Can we have an example of a job or your favorite thing to do?" And then people use that idea to kind of springboard off of. That's I think what you're talking about, right?
Right, absolutely. And yeah, that some of this nomenclature I'm using, thinking that it makes sense to everybody. But yes, you get a suggestion from the audience at the beginning of the show, and then you build based around that. And so then for a Herald, you get that suggestion from the audience. The audience gives you something. You create an opening that would be a theme. Then you have a set of scenes based off from that. Then you have a game inside that looks like it might be something similar to a short form game, but is created in the moment without any sort of finite structure. And then you return back to those scenes.
I assume there are shifts in trends in regard to material and tone in improv and comedy more broadly. I think we are in the middle of one of those public discussions, I guess, about what comedy is and can be or should be. So how do you adjust to that in an educational setting, I guess?
There's a huge shift in the world and in society. Things that people were doing in comedy in the 70s and 80s and 90s, people don't find appropriate anymore. And when you look back at it, you think, why? Why did we ever think that was appropriate? And so it's taking a look. As a teacher, we will evaluate comedians in comedy and look at it and see how it has evolved and try to understand the context of when things were done and said, and was this helpful? Was it a cheap way to get a laugh, or was it something that was productive that led to the next step. And so it is constantly evolving. And that's part of this idea of being a comedian, because you think back at some comedians and people who did improv or people who did stand-up comedy or writers or TV directors or TV writers, and you see people who were popular of an era but then didn't evolve with the rest of the country or the rest of the world. And it's something that we really concentrate on and take a look at. How do you make something that's sustainable? Because comedy should be sustainable. It doesn't necessarily have to stay stuck in one sort of time period. And it's a phrase that we use now where people will say, we'll watch something and someone will say, that still has legs. That can still run. And that's something that you really strive for, something that is inclusive and smart and will always survive and evolve.
Do you have an example of something that you've seen or rewatched recently that you were kind of surprised still works, you know, decades on?
Yeah, there's this sketch that I have. I direct one of the touring companies at Second City. And it's a sketch by a few of the guys at Second City. It was in 1996, I believe, and it's called Lucky Deal. And I just was going through the archives of our sketches, and it's about a plane crash and a couple of guys who run a car dealership who are being interviewed about a plane crash. And the reporter is interviewing them, but they just can't stop promoting their new deals on their cars. And so they keep bringing up all of the advantages to driving instead of flying. And it's something that we could run that thing forever, because it's just very funny of somebody utilizing their interview to try and sell something. It's hilarious. It's very fun.
Commerce never stops. Do you remember who wrote that?
Yeah, it was Horatio Sanz, who later went on to Saturday Night Live.
So this is a question that I ask everyone, and you kind of mentioned, we already talked about Dell, and you mentioned a high school theater teacher, I believe. But so other than those folks, is there an interaction with a teacher or mentor that kind of sticks out in your mind as, you know, kind of a life-altering experience?
Initially, I went to a two-year college near my home called Lincoln College. And I had a director there. His name was Jerry Dellinger. And he was really important in my life as well. He and my best friend, he cast us in our shows. And when we were both intimidated about moving to Chicago, he produced a show and directed a show, and we did it at the American Blues Theater here in Chicago. And we talked to him about it, and it went well. It was the play Betrayal, and it went really well. And I remember talking to him and saying, this was really great. It was really fun. And he said, well, I didn't do this for me. I did it for you guys, to show you that just because you come from a small town doesn't mean that you can't do theater in Chicago or anywhere that you want to do it. And so you determine that. So make the decision and do it. And so I did, and then moved to Chicago and have been doing theater as my primary job and teaching for the past 20 years.